Welcome to the Second Bite Podcast, where we talk with top entrepreneurs and CEOs about creating valuable companies through creative transactions. Now, let's get started with the show.
Welcome back to the Second Bite Podcast. I have a terrific guest with me today, Dan Larkman. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Todd. I'm excited.
Yeah, Dan, as you know, this is the Second Bite Podcast. We talk a lot about guys that have done transactions and are working on their second bite or realized their second bite. And those are great and they're interesting and informative. We also have a second series that we call the Go It Alone series, because partnering with private equity is not the only way to the promised land. And I think what you have been doing with Keens Digital is a good example of somebody that is choosing a route of growing organically and building a really interesting business without the help of private equity. So I want to unpack that a little bit. And if we can, maybe we even start just a little bit before the beginning, because you were at a company called Steelhouse before. We're going back about 5 or 6 years now. So maybe you could just talk about what it is that you saw as perhaps a gap in the marketplace that motivated you to start Keens.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about it, I'm thinking so I was at Steelhouse for 5 years almost. And when I joined, it was a retargeting company predominantly. And you know, it was constantly testing new things, which was great. I mean, they had a great beta program where they'd be trying new programs, new offerings. and it was really interesting. But if we go one step further back than that, when I moved to the US, I moved to the US in 2011 to help start an OTT connected TV company, right? And it was under the Iconian umbrella that's now Amobee, but it was Juiced and SmartClip. And so what was interesting there was that's what we came to, and my background's in analytics. So that's where we started. Or when I moved to the US, that's where we started. So by the time I was at Steelhouse, I was running there. I basically launched their performance team and really running, because I've always been in analytics. What was interesting was, and the really aha moment for me was actually a podcast. It was a podcast, and I was listening to Richard Branson, which everyone, you know, he's on most podcasts.
Yeah, sure.
I was listening to him, and it was something that just clicked. And it was, if you're at a company and you think you can do it better yourself, why are you still at that company? And it was that one thing that I was sitting there. And at the time, with Steelhouse, they were talking about, you know, there was beta tests for everything from TikTok to, Instagram mobile, everything was a beta test. And Connected TV was one of those beta tests. And I was sitting there thinking, I did this in 2011. A little different. 2011, we had to put the SDKs in a TV. So you had to contact Samsung and have a 10-year lead time or a 2-year lead time to get the technology in there. And different, much easier now. But I was sitting there thinking, why am I staying here to help launch it for this company when I could go and do it myself? And so, you know, it wasn't really launched there, what they're offering. And so that was really the aha moment. And the other one was, I had a conversation with someone who's actually now on our board, and I spoke to him about it, and his response, well, I spoke to him just in general about, you know, wanting to start a business. And he was like, you don't have kids. At the time, I didn't. You don't have kids. This is the only time in life you're going to get a chance to do it. So if you're going to do it right now. And it was those two things that was really that click that made me say, we should really start this. And that click to say, I want to bootstrap this and see how far we can go with what we currently have.
And so when you launched KD, you did it all by yourself, just kind of a one-man show, or did you partner with anybody?
All by myself to start with, which is, when you say go it alone, it kind of like a little PTSD back there when remembering sitting in, I did it alone, sitting in my apartment, one-bedroom apartment in Marina Del Rey in California. And I was sitting there, didn't have a second screen. So I had a flat screen TV that I used as a second screen. And I literally had two laptops. I was trying to build everything on one. And while that started going slow, I'd move over to this one and send emails and then come back to this one. And so, yeah, it was very much me solo doing it. And I say solo as in I was the only one full-time doing it. So yeah, when I think about it, it was much bigger, right? You talk about like when you're running through your pitch with your salespeople that you've worked with before, and you've got everything from the naysayers to every part of it you're taking on board. So yes, I was the driving force, but there was a lot of people that were offering advice or chipping in, positive or negative.
And so you guys are, I think, in many respects, a leader in your space. mm-hmm. which is connected TV and OTT. Can we start with a definition of what mm-hmm. does that really mean?
That, I mean, it's a great question and a broad one by itself. So when I think about it, there's two ways of looking at it. Connected TV can either be the device you're running on, so the TV screen. So, you know, think about a smart TV from, you know, a smart Samsung TV all the way through to Apple TVs, even some gaming you can watch TV through. So how we look at connected TV and OTT, or over the top television, when we talk about that, we're talking about the subscription. So we're talking about TV commercials, and there's a distinction. You can run YouTube on your TV screen, which YouTube will count as connected TV. At Keen's, we would not. Like, for us, it's going to be TV, full episodic players, TV commercials that you would usually see, Hulu's of the world, the Peacocks of the world, the HBO Maxes, those type of places where you're going to be consuming content. That's what we count as connected TV. So when we talk about connected TV ads, they are your typical TV commercial, just rather than running through your cable subscriptions, they're running through your Wi-Fi.
Got it. Do you remember your very first customer? And when you got your first customer, did you say, wow, I got a company now? Or did it take longer for you to get to that comfort level?
It took longer, for sure.
Who was the first customer?
First customer actually wasn't even Connect TV. It was a display campaign that we were running. And there was a sales guy, actually funny, there was a sales guy at Steelhouse that left to start his own company called Swipe Sum. And they're based in St. Louis. It's a card processing company. And I'd been talking to him, and he came on board with a $1,000 monthly budget. I said, no, I didn't think we'd made it at that point. That was the first customer we had. And it was the first 6 months was testing, because you're in that period where you're like, okay, I've got, you know, single to tens of thousands of dollars. You know, you're talking like,
yeah,
you know, our second client was $5,000, right? And so, you know, with you're not talking a huge amount of money left on the table, right? And so it wasn't till, I didn't feel that until March 2019. So we launched the company really October 18. It was about March, about 6 months later, when I was like, okay, we've got it.
And what was that feeling?
What did that feel like?
What triggered that for you?
What triggered it was, even if nothing worked out, the insurance policy is, this is a great consulting company that I can run and make good money on, as a, from a personal point of view. Like, if nothing works out, I can at least run a consulting company, and we've at least got enough coming in that, you know, I'm not constantly diving into savings and watching everything get smaller, smaller, smaller.
Got it.
I think that was the point. And past there was when we hit profitability. And after that, we've never looked back.
Yeah. And so we're approaching summer of 23, and you've been in business for roughly 5 years or so. Can you give me an idea on the approximate size by revenue, by people, by, any or all of those things that would just help us understand the size of the company you're running now?
Yeah. So we're in the tens of millions. We're in that range. And we've been growing pretty comfortably, you know, from, you know, the humble $1,000 client. We've been growing, you know, plus 100% year on year. I'd say everything except for last year. But I think most people saw that. I mean, we grew comfortably, you know, 45-50% growth, which is great, right? Really happy with that. And so, you know, from our side, that's what we're looking at. From a people point of view, we have, you know, I think we're about 16 full-time people and about 5 contractors that are doing different projects along the way, from, you know, marketing to et cetera. And for us, that's crucial to be at that size. What we've always had as a focus is growing revenue, using technology where we can to automate the roles that people are doing. So being pretty conscious that we've always worked from home. And so being conscious that we want enough internal conversations and meetings, I'll call them, so that we can keep that rapport and keep the culture, but not so many that you've got, you know, the whole company sitting on a meeting every day for, you know, 3 hours when you actually only need 2 people on that conversation. Yeah. or asynchronous meetings. So
do you feel the need to create your own technology, or everything you utilize is off the shelf?
So we've built out the data intelligence side of things. I'm building out more technology now, moving into more, just adding more tech to, again, automate roles, simplify roles. But really, our goal has always been the same thing, which is when we launch the company, for everyone who's part of the company, whether that's a client or it's a team member, it's how do we give people a better quality of life? And it sounds like a huge lofty goal and a little wishy-washy, right? But the goal was, rather than you spending hours pulling the levers and setting up your own campaigns, learning a new platform, reinventing the wheel, well, let us bring that expertise. But from an internal side of things, you like automation, right? We don't want to sit there doing the same thing over and over again because you don't feel like we're growing. So it's that nice balancing act. So a lot of the tech that we're building is to help our partners and to help our team internally so that the whole process is smoother and everyone really benefits from being part of Keens and working with Keens.
I had a really good podcast episode with Norm Browns from Pacific. And he had the same kind of philosophy as it relates to technology. And one of the things he said that has really still stuck with me is that we create technology so that our people are not doing the grinding, dull, boring work that makes us really good. And when I can take that away from them, that means I can hire people that really want to focus on customer experience and solving customer problems and being strategic. And that allows me to hire the best people that I can get. Are you finding the same result?
100%. I think it's the most interesting thing about the startup world is it's okay for the first couple of years to have people doing things that tech can do for them because you just don't have the time. Yeah, everyone's wearing multiple hats. But I think you reach a point when if you want to retain talent, you're only retaining talent by removing the mundane and giving them more of what they enjoy, right? And then ultimately they do better jobs. They're more innovative. They actually then start adding to the product,
right,
and improving the product you built. So you've kind of created that self-fulfilling cycle, which is where we're at. And it's really exciting. It's also just growth of individuals. No one wants to sit there doing the same, you know, copy and pasting in from one sheet to the next. And I've been there. I've been at tech companies or you know, companies that will claim the tech that they have. And there's humans copy and pasting numbers from an Excel spreadsheet to a Google sheet and to here. And you're like, it's like this could be automated.
And so because of that, do you find that you get better employee retention? And do you find that that employee retention leads to better customer retention?
Yes. Yeah, I think that the focus that we've always had is on the team and their growth. You know, whether that's, you know, the perks of, you know, unlimited vacation, whether that's the perks of, you know, things like First Friday we do, which is, you know, if everyone's working from home, we give everyone on the team $100 on their first weekend of the month to go out, get dinner, get drinks with your friends, just get out the house, right? And so whether that's it, or it's through to just the daily task, how do we automate that? And how do we use tech? And I think that has improved retention, but it also improves a close-knit team where people are really trying to see how they can improve. You know, again, from day one, I've been saying to the team, if you're an account manager, your job isn't an account manager. Your job is to automate your own job. If you can you will constantly be evolving to the point where you are an expert in this area and you're really just a consultant and all that back-end stuff that you need is done for you because we're working out those.
Yeah, you know, the conversation I had with Norm was great. Anyone listening, you can Google that, Norm Browns or Pacific Company is the name of the company. You and he are alike from a tech focus. Mm-hmm. Other firms that look to accomplish what we're describing here, if they don't have the technology, they'll do that offshore. They'll do it in Costa Rica or the Philippines or someplace mm-hmm. else. What do you think is the difference between somebody that tries to accomplish efficiency that way versus through their own technology?
There's pros and cons of both, as I look at it. I think about the offshore as more like a Band-Aid approach, that it does fix it, but you're still having to train someone to do this. And you're still having to, that communication still has to go back and forth. Like we use Monday.com for project management on the back end. And I always find it fascinating when someone, say, let's say an account manager is asking an analyst a question. The amount of time it took them to answer that question, they could have gone in and found the answer. And so that's what I talk about when we talk about offshoring, is that you've taken it from the account manager to be able to feel like the expert and do the work to outsource it. They have to ask all those questions to outsource it. And now it's still two humans interacting, which often means, well, I don't really understand your question, so I'm going to ask another question. You go back and forth. And especially if you're talking different time zones. So for me, it's like, if you can build the tech that's going to make that easier and automate it, number one, you're empowering the team. And number two, you're building something that is a long-term sustainable thing rather than a short-term band-aid fix.
Makes sense. You had your the customers that you serve, mm-hmm. are they larger enterprise or they're mid-sized small business?
There's a good combination. We look at ourselves as a premium offering in the connected TV space, but without a premium price tag. And what I mean by that is your options in this space is to go self-service, right, where you're going to be pulling the levers yourself. And that's great if you're a small, medium enterprise, right, where you're used to doing Facebook, you like your hands, you want your hands on the keyboards. That's great, but it's not great for that business that is, you know, $100 million in revenue. Right, that team, you need experts in each field, and so what we find is that's a lot of the sweet spot is those enterprise relationships where you can grow them, you can be part of their team, you can be offering advice from a consulting point of view, but also we use our data intelligence and the tech that we're building out to help them grow and help them achieve the goals that they're setting. And your other option is either self-service or is to go to agencies and buy through an agency that will have a markup fee. And a lot of them buy from companies like us because we have the expertise, we have the relationships with the networks, the audience providers, and it works out much cheaper for them. So rather than building a team out, they'll take their fee and then they'll buy it through us.
Right.
And so it's like, actually, you can cut that out by doing it this way.
Got it. So now you had mentioned you're in the tens of millions in revenue. And when I matched that statement up with 16, 17 people, is it fair to guess you're closer to the 10 to 20 million versus the 50 to 60 million of revenues?
Let's say it's less than 50, but more than 20.
Okay, great. So now this is my question. For a company of that size, mm-hmm. what have you found to be the most difficult hire, the position to solve for that you think is going to lead you to that next level of growth?
That is a great question.
Because while you're thinking about it, what I hear oftentimes is I need somebody to do sales, and they hire the first person that they can. And the interesting thing is, and we'll segue a little bit now towards private equity. Private equity has, I don't think, ever uttered the words, we're going to hire a sales guy, right? They build out a sales function. They hire three or four salespeople and a manager at once because they realize in a small shop, hiring one person means four, five, 6 months from now, we're going to have no salespeople and we're going to have to start this process over again. So I hear it at that level. And then I oftentimes hear somebody that wants to hire a COO so they can get away from doing the day-to-day operations of the business. And I would say that for folks that I've interacted with might have like a 90% fail rate. Are any of those things on your objectives?
Not so much. We've got a good sales team. I think that the hires that I don't think we've struggled with hiring, right? We've been very lucky. I have a great network of people that believe in what we're doing. And so, yeah, we have a COO. But unlike that, where it's like, let me get out of the weeds, it's more, you know, our COO is great from a, you know, personal leadership point of view and sitting down with the team and helping them grow as well as helping the company grow. So multiple objectives. And so it's kind of a divide and conquer. So I've always believed when we're growing the team, is to be looking at different skill sets, complementary and conflicting, that's fine, skill sets that people have, and then making sure we're doing the most of that. I think that probably if I was thinking about the hardest role to hire is how deep going into the tech world, whether you're hiring a senior person in the tech world or a junior person in the tech world who's, you know, the scrappier side, which is more startup versus the more structured side. But I agree with you. I think that a common fault, as I've seen it, is people will bring in a head of sales. They bring in three salespeople, and then they're now a huge investment into sales, and you've only got three individual contributors. Now, we know they're not all going to work. And so you're basically expecting that one or two of these people are going to be paying for the salary of four.
Yeah. Right?
And so it's a case of how do you mitigate that, but with still creating consistent training? And it's funny, I got asked a question because we're going to be in Cannes this year. I got asked a question for, we're sponsoring a beach, and one of the questions was, around challenges, and I was like, the biggest challenge was admin sucks. Yeah. But it's not outsourcing it or giving it away, it just sucks. No one tells you that when you launch a business, right? They don't say, you launch a business and everyone, little tangent, our neighbors runs he's a CEO of a recruitment company. His kids got the Oculus set, And one of the games, I don't know even who made this game, was being a CEO. And they're like, his son was like, great, you just tell people what to do and eat donuts. And I was like, well, I eat donuts. I ask people to do stuff, but I'm probably spending a lot of time doing admin.
On follow-up,
And I was like, that is not in the game. This is an unrealistic game.
So let me ask you this then, since you've had success with it, for folks that are listening, is there a tip that you would offer as it relates to the COO in terms of, you know, training, integration, hire decision, expectation, any of those things? That, because I know yours has worked out very well.
I think I would say, number one, if it's a senior role like that that you're hiring for, especially at the size we're at and when we brought Fiona on, I would be saying you need someone who you know and that you have some level of trust with. You know, the hardest thing for any founder is you're relinquishing some level of control. And so you have to have enough of a relationship that it's not conflicting, right? And by that, I mean, you know, I'm giving over a huge amount of, no, I'll call the word power, it's the wrong word, but a lot of power to Fee to be able to have conversations with the team. I have to have full trust that she's not going to be saying something that contradicts me. And now it looks like it's a her versus me, which has never happened. But like, that's something that I would say is crucial. And I've known her for years and fully trust her and know she's an expert and know that the team will trust her. And so it was a case of that's the core foundation. And then the other thing is, what tasks do you want them to achieve and what tasks are their best skill set? So although Fee and I have overlapping skills in certain areas, she has a lot. She has skills that are very complementary in one area and I'm slightly different in other areas. And so I'll take lead here and she'll take lead here. And then I'd say the final thing is, even though I said it's complementary, you want to trust them, you also want to make sure it's someone who is going to hold you accountable. Because if it's a yes person, you're not going to get anywhere. Like Fee will often tell me, I don't like this idea. And we'll go back and forth on how we think we get there. And it's with the same goal. We want the best for Kings and we want the best for the team.
What would she say was the number one reason that she joined a small shop like this when she did?
I think she would say it was because of our relationship. You know, it's having that great network of people. When I talked about Juiced, Juice and Smarter, when I moved to the US, she was actually my boss when I came over. And the fun story is she's one of the reasons I moved to the US. I was in Australia, walked past her office. I was just like an employee of the year award, that thing. Walked past her office and she was like, Dan, come in here a second. I need a role here in the US. Would you want to do this? Yes. And she was actually the reason. So, and we just kind of stayed in contact. And then when this opportunity came up, she approached me about it. It wasn't something we were thinking about, but she approached me and I was like, this would be like to bring on someone with that caliber, that level of expertise is number one, flattering that.
Sure, they would do it.
But like also just like, yeah, that level of trust. And that. So I think that if she was going to, it'd be like, she's seen what we were doing. I've lent on her for stuff in the past. I think she would be saying, that's why I knew this is a great opportunity. And there's things that she can help with to really amplify and grow the company.
So you have, I would think by most measures, been a very large success over the first 5 years of being in business. What do you think the next 5 years bring?
A great question. So we bootstrapped it from the beginning. I don't see that happening over the next 5 years. I think there will probably be either external investment, M&A conversations, whether we're acquiring companies or we get acquired at some point. I think that this, to maintain the success, is to look at some of the stuff that's coming out. A lot more talk around AI and how you can integrate that. A lot more focus on the human element and making sure that we are using the technology as best as possible, but we're bringing that consulting forward. And I think continuing that way, I think that we have a very strong enterprise sales team. And I think that that's only going to amplify. And something that we focus pretty hard on is, you know, we're in an uncertain time from an economic point of view. So it's like, we've been very fortunate to be able to put cash in the bank. We're now using that in a way of being able to, whether that's M&A or whether that's getting in front of more of these enterprise advertisers to really have those conversations. So I think the next 5 years just really amplifies what we've been doing. And we're hitting that, I call it like the second wave of growth. We had a big wave of growth. I think we're hitting the second or third wave where it's like, okay, we need to now look at some more of the structure, some more of the culture and where we invest to really hit those next levels
and
those next.
And so I would imagine, like a lot of people listening, you've had a bunch of folks knock on the door from private equity and from strategics and the rest. Mm-hmm. But talk about private equity first. Is there something that you're inherently hesitant about with private equity? Is it mostly a timing thing, or do you think that that's the most likely path at some point in the future?
I'm not sure if it's the most likely path. I think the hesitation from the beginning was in previous roles I've seen and been part of, either I've been part of board meetings, helped put board decks together, or from beginning to end. And the conversations have always been with their VCs, and the conversation constantly and the chatter was always around, you know, got out of the boardroom, they want to set out more margin. With it, you know, like we, you know, why we weren't hitting numbers, you know, that was tough. And it's like, rather than how we kind of set ourselves up, was to be able to have an open conversation. What's going well, what's not going well. Like I always found it odd, and this is many companies, but I always found it odd when people, the execs came out of the room and they're like, yeah, we dodged that one.
Yeah.
Like, dodge what? Like, you're in a board meeting. Like, these are, you're in a room of people who have done this before. Like, give it to them raw. Tell them, like, you know, this isn't working.
Right.
And they're going to come with, they've got vested interest in it. And it kind of jaded me a little bit to say, I don't want to be in a conversation where I'm being told what to do. I want to be in a conversation of experts, which is how we kind of put our board together, of people who have a vested interest in the success, but also have a, but understand that it's not mandating. It's, you could invest more here. Our board's great. They turn around to us and they're like, you put too much cash in the bank. You need to be investing more, right? You're actually not investing as much as we think to actually really grow this. Okay, great, great insight in areas that you might not know because you're a finance person or you know, the legal side, that type of stuff. So that's how I kind of think about the hurdles that, or the perceived hurdles, I should say, of why we bootstrapped and where we are now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it may just be the folks that you were dealing with before. It may just be the time versus where we are today. But, you know, at this end, the interesting thing is at this size of business, there is more need to get the return that private equity is looking for. There's a need. You can't financially engineer that. We can't cut people. We can't do that. We need to grow this business. And we need to grow this business with Dan's full authority and approval because, A, he's a significant owner in the business, but he knows the business and we don't, right? He's the one that's supposed to guide us through the, you know, the valley of darkness, as opposed, and hopefully we can give him advice based on other experiences and then provide the financing to accomplish what it is that he looks to accomplish.
Yeah, and I think that's where the pros come in, though. I think that's when I think about any type of external investment, it's more about when we are talking about the M&A conversation, whether that's us acquiring companies or not, or being acquired, the conversation always comes down to me, which is who has their ear to the ground best? Because just like I talked about everyone in the company, it's a skill set, the best skill set and a complementary skill set. I think the same thing can be said for private equity is if your ear's to the ground, you're going to know what companies are looking to be acquired. You'll know who's looking to acquire. What's realistic, right? And you're able to have those type of conversations and bring those to the forefront and add value in an area that, you know, may be deficient. If, you know, if I was going to say, honestly, I'm not the guy with my ear to the ground of the next company that's looking to be acquired.
Yeah, and nor should you be, right? But the interesting thing is, and I've seen this firsthand, but also, again, for listeners, go to the search bar and look for the conversation that we have with Grayson LaFrenz from Power Digital or from Mike Mothner from W Promote. And what they speak about is, you know, it was no surprise what we were doing, right? We spent hours with our private equity group and our board talking about what is this company going to look like in the future? If we have a weakness, where can we shore that up? If we want to acquire, what would be the areas we're going to acquire in most? Private equity doesn't show up and say, Dan, you're going to be so excited on Monday when you see the company we bought because, you know, we're the majority owner in the business, because there's no quicker way to destroy value than that is. So I think, you know, as you have that experience, I think you'll see more and more that you are not only integral to the underwriting and due diligence process from a strategic standpoint, you're the one identifying, you know, the, like I said, that path forward through the valley of darkness, if you will.
Yeah. And I think that's how I see it. And I think, yeah, I listened to, as an example, the W Promote with Mike from W Promote, right?
Yeah.
To that podcast, I thought it was great, right? I thought it was really interesting how he was approaching it, how he's still heavily involved. And I love how he phrased, when I took on investment, you've paid for what I've done. I've now at this point, this is the starting point for you. So I haven't achieved anything. You know, mentality, I was like, I love that. Because I think that sometimes everyone needs that little, you know, kick in the butt, let's say.
Yeah, and for anyone listening on the website at secondbitepodcast.com in the show notes, there we'll make sure that there's a link to Mike Mothner's podcast. But he's at W Promote. You can search that pretty easily. Let me just ask a couple last things, and I'll let you run. A lot of the guys that are when you join with private equity, they're like, hey, we need to have a board, right? And the board can be relatively small. And it's, mm-hmm. it starts this kind of formal process of doing the things you mentioned with your COO, encouraging you, holding you responsible, mm-hmm. giving you constructive criticism and the rest. I don't see a lot of guys at your stage that have a board. Can you talk about your thought process when you created that, how you picked them? And can you first describe who's on the board now and how many people there are and the rest?
Yeah, so the board's small right now. It's 3 people. And how we picked them was people that I'd worked with before or had strong relationships with before, as in, like, you know, I know these people well, I have full trust in them, and again, have very different looks into the world as I look at it, if that makes sense. So yeah, we've got one person who is from a financial background, but a financial and a legal background. So great to be, you know, you always want that finance person who's telling you to spend less and make more, right?
Right.
Ironically, he's saying the opposite. But great to have that type of insight from, you know, the point of view of being able to bring that more of a financial look, more of a, like, you know, when you start a company, you're going to know some of the financial terms, but you don't know all of them. And so, you know, it's much nicer when you're like doing your first 409A as an example, right? And you got someone who's sitting there and he's like, this is how they're really asking you this, Dan. And so you got everything from that. And then the other side is, you know, everyone's industry people, right? And so that's the first and foremost is sitting in the same industry. And then from the other side, it's more like from an operational point of view, you know, the checks and balances, and some of it comes on those conversations about, I've always done it this way. And so I think about it as less of, when we think about a board, we think about more like the private equity side, more like those, you know, a room full of people. I see it as more like an advisory conversation that we have once every 6 weeks, right? Where we're really running through, here is what we set the goals are for the year. Here is where we're at. Here's where our EBITDA is. Here is where, you know, here's our top clients. Here are the hurdles that we're facing. Here are the trends. Like, I'm a data person, so I'm going to look at all the trends. I need someone to say, yeah, you're looking at the trends, but the actual issues here that you're seeing. And just someone who's kind of going through that way. So that's how we look at our board. It's more like an advisory group. And it's, again, it comes back to exactly the same thing as with Fee, was, how do we choose someone who's going to hold us accountable? How do we choose someone who's going to tell me that I'm wrong? And here is the path that we should be going on. And doesn't mean we're going to go down it. But we can have that open conversation and have that level of trust. So for me, that's why I would say 3 months into the company, these conversations were being had. And I thought the most interesting thing was the amount of people that we've maybe pitched to, clients, senior companies, ask us if they can join our board, which I was not expecting, that we're going to have so many people ask, which is flattering. And, you know, it's not necessarily how we set the board up for that reason, but I thought it was very interesting. I was not expecting that when I founded the company.
Very interesting. Dan, this was a great episode, and I appreciate you sharing. I want to end with giving you the opportunity to be a Richard Branson, perhaps, for somebody. So if somebody's listening out there, is there a piece of observation or even advice that was important to you as you launched and grew teens into what it is today that you thought was particularly important that you would share?
Yeah, I think that the most important thing that, as I see it, is when you're starting a company, a lot of people, you're going to have a lot of naysayers who think that there's a better way of doing it, the wrong way of doing it. And you're also, if you're smart, you're going to be looking at the numbers and saying, especially if you have a salary, here's how much I earn. I'm going to go from that to zero. Mm-hmm. And if I get a pay rise next year and the year after, this is what my total income would be by then. And here is what my total income is. So if you're smart, you won't do it. So you have to, the first thing I would say is don't be scared to execute. Like I know a lot of people that spend 6 months, 8 months, a year on trying to design something to be perfect. You don't have to spend as long on it. I thought we needed a really great user interface when we launched. Right? I launched the company with Excel reporting and no one complained. Hmm. Right? Now you're not going to be getting the enterprise clients with Excel reporting, but you're going to get some clients in. And we were profitable. We ran it for about a year and change with Excel reporting. I would say execute fast, have trust in yourself, but don't think you're going to have to do it alone. Lean on everyone you know who is in the industry, is not in the industry, who has advice, whether it's good or bad, lean on it, but trust your own instinct is what I would say. And I think that's the core thing that makes the difference between companies that I've seen be successful and companies I haven't. And so I think that's probably the best advice that I could give. But the same accent. So
well, you never know, right? You never know what the ripple would be, and the accent is spot on. So well done there. This has been really a great episode. So I appreciate you spending the time. I appreciate the insight. It'll be great to watch KD and how you develop over the balance of 23 and into the future. So Dan Larkman, thanks for spending time with us. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. And thanks for always being an ear that I can bounce ideas off as well, Todd. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Second Bite podcast. We'll see you again next time. And be sure to click subscribe to get future episodes.